The John Age Project.
Trust no one. Trust no one. Trust no one.
Thanks for joining us today in the Anomic Age. I'm indeed your host, John H. Thanks for tuning in to the program today. Before we move on, please check out AnomicAge.com. Share that link with your friends, family, loved ones, and enemies. Lots of great stuff on there. I've been doing additions just about every other day to the information breakdown segments. So you can find that there pretty much all in the 30-minute range. A little bit shorter, vastly commentary on my end on various things going on as the country slides into the abyss. So I've been doing that for a while now. So I decided to just culminate all of them into one spot so you don't have to look at Brighteon and BitChute and YouTube and so forth to get them. So now you can just check it out at AnomicAge.com. From there, you can also check out the PayPal link and the Patreon link. If you are so inclined, I'd be real excited for some donations right about now. I'd like to make some improvements around here and get some things even better. So if you can do that, please do so. You can also go direct paypal.me/AnomicAge if you want to make it a monthly thing, or you can just go to paypal.me/AnomicAge. Make it a one-time thing. Doesn't matter to me. Nevertheless, you can also sign up for the newsletter and you can check out all of the guests from the past year and a half or so. Tons of great guests out there, and there's tons more on the way. You can check out all the video, all the audio, and all those guest links and more at AnomicAge.com. That being said, we got a great guest coming up for you in just a mere matter of moments. Going to talk to you for the first time, Mr. Andrew Thorpe King on the other side. So please stick around, stay in your seats for a mere matter of moments, and we'll join our guest on the other side. All right, it is my pleasure to welcome Mr. Andrew Thorpe King into the Anomic Age today. After graduating cum laude with a bachelor's degree in English literature, Andrew chose to continue working at the steel plant he had worked at throughout college. During that time, he received a real-life lesson in Spanglish while growing a strong appreciation for the working class lifestyle. It was amidst this season of life, while training for a natural bodybuilding competition, that he began his writing discipline in the form of a daily journal, entries, and poems. His experience in intense bodybuilding training by day and factory work by night germinated a large volume of writing. Andrew then began giving a slew of spoken word performances throughout the college town of Westchester, Pennsylvania, before diverting his energies into singing in a hardcore punk band. Around that time, he also began writing freelance for a handful of music magazines like Rockpile and Chord. Andrew's writings then took a backseat for years as adult life took over. He got married in 1999 and has three children. Professionally, he decided that writing about music was not profitable enough to pave the path to sustainability for his life and family. During a bout of unemployment, he maxed out his credit cards and created Thorpe Records, a hardcore punk record label. Thorpe Records steadily grew until 2006, where he also started Sailor's Grave Records to focus more on the subculture genres of street punk, rock and roll, oi, and psychobilly. between the two labels. He had released successful indie recordings from world-renowned acts such as Blood for Blood, The Business, U.S. Bombs, Ducky Boys, Kings of Nuttin, Madball, Coughing Cats, and Sheer Terror. Collectively, the labels have released 100-plus recordings and counting. Along with running two record labels, Andrew also worked in various consulting, sales, and management capacities throughout his career in the independent music industry for Relapse Records, Lumberjack, Mortem Distribution, and Independent Label Collective. Andrew always felt a strong affinity towards the musical platform of punk rock because of its ability to allow one to express true feelings of pain and personal struggle while simultaneously providing a soundtrack for the strength to overcome. Along with all that, Andrew's also done so much more. We'll sort of hit the highlight reel here. An amazing amount of books here. Blaze, Operation Persian Trinity, Failure Rules, The Hardcore Times Handbook for the Diehard Entrepreneur, The Lounge, Where There's Smoke, There's Family, Stupid, The True Root Cause of Hegemonic Islam, and so much more. Andrew, man, I wish you'd get to work. It's not you're doing anything over there.
Well, I will confess, a few of those books have not yet come out. The only one that's out so far is Blaze Operation Persian Trinity, which was my first spy thriller, which is kind of a geopolitical spy thriller with some prophecy elements to it, lots of humor, lots of color, lots of, could have been more action, but action oriented. And then I'm working on two books now. I just finished the first draft of Caliph, Ottoman Rising, which is a book that I'm co-authoring with Joel Richardson, who's New York Times bestselling author of The Islamic Antichrist. So he writes, all fiction stuff. He's an expert on Middle East terrorism, prophecy, that type of stuff. And he's a world-renowned speaker and author. And so that's now in his hands, and he's now applying his treatment to the text. So I'm looking forward to working through that. You know, there'll be a lot of kind of the meat grinder of going back and forth of editing and all of that. And we hope to have that out sometime next year. I'm very excited about that. That, again, is also kind of a spy thriller. And then I'm also, while he's working on that, I'm deep into putting the finishing touches on Failure Rules, which is the one book you mentioned there. Subtitle has now changed. It's changed. It's Failure Rules with an exclamation mark. The eight rules of failure for entrepreneurs, creatives, and authentics. So that's the name there. So that's what's on my plate right now.
I love it, man. Yeah, that's what I was reading here a couple hours ago. And I was telling my wife and everybody, I was like, we got to read this. Looks amazing, man. I was so pumped. It was very much inspiring while I was reading this. And really what resonated with me when I first found your work and heard about you is that you came from sort of similar backgrounds to me. I mean, for me, I sort of say I found punk. It didn't really find me. Like, I felt like a very much Land of Misfit Toys kid that was into skateboarding and drawing, and I didn't fit in anywhere. I mean, even with later on with skating and punk, I felt like even in that sense, I was kind of like, well, I'm sort of the oddball here too. How ironic is that? But
yeah,
sort of that ethos that kind of got me into what I always believed it should have been about. And then I sort of juxtapose that, and I'll admit fully, my pulse is not in that genre or anything anymore. Yeah. I'm kind of retired, but when I look at what it is now, and I even listen to interviews and read stuff from some of the folks, I would say I admire, but I guess I follow those bands back in the day, and I'm kind of like, man, what, did I miss the boat or did they miss the boat? Cause I thought it was all about doing what you wanted and not telling somebody what to do and not ostracizing and saying, oh, you can't wear that shirt here, and now it's sort of turned into like the jock cool guys click at the high school lunch table or something.
Well, it's really strange too. I mean, I guess that's one of the things that I really come, the older I get, the more I'm very averse to groups in general. I mean, I think of like, the quote, the comedian Bill Burr, he's quoted as saying, F you and your groups,
Oh yeah, me too.
It's part of one of his bits. And you know, I think about that and I feel the same way. I mean, whatever group I'm in, I can't fit. It can't fit in groups, you know, whatever exactly. It is, whether it's punk rock, whether it's something in academia, whether it's the corporate world, whether it's even sometimes in family settings, whether it's, you know, in some sort of religious setting or political setting, I don't fit into a group.
Yeah.
And I think we miss the mark when we think that we have to fit into groups, you know, with some sort of certainty and some perfect fit, you know? And for me, that's always what punk rock was about. It was about individualism. Punk rock was agnostic to ideology. It shouldn't have mattered what the ideology was. Punk rock was a spirit. It was an attitude. It was an approach on expressing your individuality regardless of your surroundings. It was really kind of an anti-group mentality that formed a group, you know? So it was always strange to me when all of a sudden there became these increasing unwritten rules on what it meant to be punk rock. And if you didn't fit them, you didn't fit in. I mean, I think of like, I grew up mostly on New York hardcore, and that sound, whether it was from New York or not, you know, a lot of Boston bands too had that New York hardcore sound.
No, I'm right there with you.
I think of that the uniqueness of that scene when you have bands like the Cro-Mags and Shelter, who are kind of preaching Hare Krishnaism and veganism, and then you also have bands like Sheer Terror, which are pretty much anti everything. I mean, they made fun of straight edgers, they made fun of, you know. You know, any ideology. I mean, they're almost anti-ideology, and there's a bit of kind of blue-collar realism, maybe a tinge of nihilism, you know. And then you have the Bad Brains, which is Rastafarianism, and then you have, you know, obviously a lot of the, you know, some you know, left-wing politics that comes into it. And then you have kind of New York bands like Agnostic Front, who, you know, were famously kind of criticized in the 80s, even by like Phil Donahue for their song Public Assistance, which really kind of railed against the abuse of the welfare system, you know, and that was called racist, even though Roger Moret, friend of mine, singer, is, you know, has 100% Latino tattooed on his neck, and he's a Cuban immigrant, and he was on the welfare system himself, but the song was about the abuse of welfare, you know, so you had even like that, which was kind of cradled as this, you know, kind of right-wing kind of band at the time. I don't think anybody would think of them that way now. But there was just this diverse sense of you could be who you wanted, and that fit you into this group of disparate misfits. And you didn't have to be like the other disparate misfits. That's the whole idea. It was disparate. And nowadays, it's like even that scene has succumbed to groupthink. You know, the scene that said smash the state is now, you know, applauding and championing political ideology that says expand the state, empower the state, give the state more of your life. I don't understand any of it. It doesn't make any sense to me. You know, for me, the natural kind of outgrowth of punk rock is more of a libertarianism slant. Really just like, you know, back to Ben Franklin, you know, as long as you either break my bones or pick my pockets, however that phrase goes, then you're okay with me, you know? And I think we need to kind of migrate back to that type of individuality and freedom of thought and tolerance for ideas of that are complete opposite what we believe and get away from this kind of, you know, I call it like the brick think, right? I mean, you think of the Tower of Babel, you know, it was like building the bricks to the sky, you know, and the bricks are the symbol of sameness, you know, and we're not all bricks. We're not supposed to be. You know, we're uniquely created in the knitted together in our mother's womb, and we're like stones, each of us different with individual cracks and crevices and blemishes and shiny spots, and we're all a mix. We're not all supposed to have the same talents. We're not all supposed to have the same outcomes in life. You know, we're going to get different kind of you know, cards of fate dealt to us, and it's who we are and how we apply our free will to, you know, either our intellect or a sense of providence that ends up giving us that uniqueness, you know? And so, you know, I think that's a lot of what my Failure Rules book is about. I mean, the book is really, you know, it's agnostic to ideology. It's agnostic to specific faiths, but it is about kind of that, the divinity of purpose within us, right? And the internal spirit voice within us. And what is it in our quiet moments that becomes our internal compass to make us go? And, you know, for many people, that is their faith. for other people, it might be a similar voice that they don't recognize as God's. But I think that voice is in all of us. You know, the Christians would call it the Holy Spirit. And I think it's that voice that really, you know, if we allow it to be muzzled, we won't be able to really truly follow kind of our mysterious calling journey. If we listen to it and we kind of, you know, just put brackets around our consciousness and kind of like just get rid of the white noise around us and listen to that, I think that's when we can really find out who we are and what we're supposed to be and how that evolves over time, you know. And so the book Failure Rules is really about that journey and how failure has fit into so many successful people's story, particularly in terms of it being the pivot point that really carried meaning, gave them clarity, stripped them of all encumbrances, and brought them into alignment with that calling journey.
Yeah, man. I couldn't agree more with what you're saying. I definitely want to get back to this, but I just had to throw this out there while we were talking because I was thinking about it. When I was growing up with this, and I know I probably sound like an old man, isn't my like, oh, in your day, but I mean, that's kind of how it was. There seemed to be a real camaraderie within punk. Camaraderie. Thank you.
Yeah, sure.
And it didn't matter where you were. Like, you could be in New York, you could be in Florida, Texas, California, and you automatically had that sort of built-in, like, yo, they got my back. You know, you see that guy. Yeah. I saw a guy at the gym probably like 5-6 years ago now, but you know, we look like nothing in common, but I kept looking. I was like, man, that's a Madball shirt, you know? And I kind of was like, that's a Madball shirt? And he's like, oh, yeah, man, I grew up in Jersey or whatever. I used to love hardcore and we got in the military and all that, you know? But we started talking, and immediately we had that bonding point.
Yeah.
And now it just seems like all these little divisive fissures are all over the place where it's like, oh, well, they're not real punk. They're XYZ punk. And it's just sad, you know, that it came to that, I guess.
Yeah, well, it mirrors the world right now, right? I mean, it's like this kind of distortion of the camaraderie of commonality, you know, within groups, to the point now where you're only identified by the specificity of you know, these kind of identity markings, you know, whether it's you know, the music you listen to, or you know, whatever it could be, you know, your ethnicity, your sexual preference, your political tribe, your philosophical tribe. It's like, whatever happened to, we're just individuals, you know?
Yeah.
And, I don't know why we all have to be anything but individuals, you know? And it goes back to, like, you know, the idea of the bricks of sameness and then the stones of individuality and you know, kind of the fight between those two mentalities in the world.
Yeah. I mean, I think that the cult of academia is kind of one of those big hegemonic cornerstones of this, because I think it really beats out that individuality. I mean, that's been doing that for a long time, but even more so now, they beat out that entrepreneurial spirit. And they definitely, like, if you fail, oh, it's terrible. Like, you might as well go hide in a corner. You failed. Yeah. You're a loser for life. Now you got the A or whatever on your chest for life. Instead of being like, yeah, man, like, I failed at this. It's all right, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, like, going back to skating, like, oh, you didn't land that trick the first time. I didn't just go home, like, okay, well, screw it. I'm just going to sit in my room, I guess, you know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, you have to have the ability to, you know, be thinking and to learn from what were, you know, our mistakes, but we also have to have the fearlessness to be fools and go forth anyway. We don't really know what we're doing. You know, you take in as much information as you can, make the best decision you can, you go forth knowing that you're probably going to fail. Then you just try to fail fast. You try to recover quickly, learn from it, and keep moving. It's that grittiness that, like, you know, gives us the thrill of life, gives us meaning and builds strength over time, you know? And I think we lose that when we sanitize our experiences, whether it be a career path or, you know, how you navigate life and develop relationships, whatever it may be. When we think that everything's supposed to be buttoned up and perfect, we're all supposed to have these linear lives. Well, we're not. You know, there's zigzags, there's up, there's downs. I mean, you know, I've lost it all several times. You know, I've gone through a divorce. You know, I've had lots of up and downs, and every one has been invaluable in teaching me the full context of who I am, giving me kind of a now an innate ability to be detached from materialism and circumstances, and yet at the same time know how to maximize circumstances better as I move forward, whether it be building wealth, building a strong relationship, you know, with my wife, I'm remarried, I've been divorced, all these things, you know, like I'm not ashamed of any of it. Failure is a part of it. And, you know, in many ways, I'm going to wear it as a badge of honor and point to it as a teacher, you know. And I think it was Zig Ziglar said, you know, as long as failure is your teacher and not your undertaker, it's all good, you know. So, you know, that's a big part of kind of my passion right now is exploring stories that point to failure as really being the start of success.
I like that, man. That sounds good. Not your undertaker, man. I'm going to have to think about that and write down. That's good stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's true. I mean, so much of everything, often find myself telling my daughter stories. I'm like, yeah, this scar is where this happened. Don't do that. You know, like this scar over here, right. I didn't listen to my dad and I was playing in the bathroom.
You're kind of happy. You kind of like the scars though, too, don't you?
Yeah, exactly.
See, that's the thing. I mean, that's just failure. Failure is the scars. And you look back, you're like, yeah, that really sucked. If I didn't have that scar, I wouldn't think this way. And if I didn't think this way, then that wouldn't have happened. And you know what? In retrospect, that scar rules, you know? So therefore, failure rules, you know? That's,
yes,
that's the book, you know? I mean, that's how you got to view it, you know? Just,
you know. And the tattoos, too. Like, for me, I'm like, man, this was a dumb move. I shouldn't have been doing that at 17.
Do you have some regret? Did you get tattoos now or no? You're done.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just saying, like, they're kind of mile markers, you know? Like, you look back and oh, I remember when this happened. Like, that was a stupid relationship or whatever.
Sure. Well, look, I got my ex-wife's name still tattooed on my shoulder, and my daughter laughs. She's like 14. She's like, that one's awkward, Dad. I'm like, yeah, I know. I'm going to get that one X'd out. Well, I already got my new wife's name tattooed on me. I mean, whatever. It's a roadmap to your past. That's what Henry Rollins used to say, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, that's why, even though I have a lot of them, I still have some more room left, and I try not to go too fast, because you got to let the experiences accumulate so you can then document them in the future and in all its color and glory in your skin, you know? So, you know, I love them. I don't have any regret. I had one that I covered up just for aesthetic reasons because it didn't fit with my sleeve kind of motif anymore. But other than that, I mean, I've been getting them since I was 16. I'm 46 now. So yeah. For 30 years, and I still get two or three a year. I already got my next two picked out. You know, it's just, and by day, I'm an executive banker for a commercial bank in the fintech space, financial technology space. And you know, I cover them all up. You know, nobody sees them. Nobody knows I have them. Nothing on the neck, nothing on the hands. And you know, it's all good. You know, it's just, it's a part of my life that I've always had a passion for. I mean, people say, oh, are you addicted to them? And no, I mean, when I was 12, first time I saw somebody with lots of tattoos, I knew when I was older, I wanted to be that way. And then just the way my brain works and just associating life and experience and passions with art, there's just no way I could document what I viewed to be indelible or permanent or, you know, either principles or attributes of my personality. There's no way I couldn't put that on my skin. And you know, I still feel the same way. So.
Another thing I wanted to talk about, because I was reading, you gave me this excerpt here that was amazing, man. Detach from the optics of failure. That's what I was reading. I was reading a minute ago in the car. We had like a pit stop running air. I was like, I'll just sit in the car and read this. You know, it was great, but it was so succinct, but so truthful. And just, yeah, like, don't listen to a bunch of BS. I mean, you know, if somebody's telling you you're nothing, you're a loser, don't listen to it.
I'll read that if you don't mind for your
sure, audience. Man. Go for it. I would happily listen to it again.
So yeah, so this is it's a sample from my forthcoming book, Failure Rules: The 8 Rules of Failure for Entrepreneurs, Creatives, and Authentics. And so the concept of the book really is it's a distillation of my own experiences, the things I believe I've learned from failure, the values of failure. And I don't mean willful failure. I mean failure that you fought stridently against and it happened anyway, and then you learn from it. You know, like not like kneeling at the altar of failure some twisted way. Like, I don't want to fail. Nobody does, of course, but there's value in it. And so I kind of laid out 8 rules. I identified these 8 rules of failure. And within each one, I have like different anecdotes from public figures and, you know, personal anecdotes and people I know. I mean, and the diversity of people that are either quoted or subject of the case studies is very wide. So I mean, it's everybody from like Lemmy from Motorhead to Winston Churchill to investor and chess player James Altucher, to the boxer Jack Johnson, to Captain Tony Tarantino, to, you know, Tolkien, to Elon Musk, to Leo Tolstoy, Gene Simmons, you know, Henry Rollins, Rodney Dangerfield, Neil Armstrong, just a variety of different people that I take a look at, and they fit in one way or another to one of these eight rules of failure. The eight rules of failure are: failure purifies, nothing is safe, money is spiritual. And another one is called build your thing one and thing two dependency, which is kind of a philosophy around failure prevention. And then you are not your failures is failure rule number five. And that's what this article is attached to that I'll read in a second. Failure rule number six is be addicted to enthusiasm. Number seven is don't resist the conditioning of failure. And failure rule number eight is in the grip of failure, respect the S words. And the S words are silence, solitude, sorrow, and slumber. So it kind of goes through all of those with a variety of different just stories and, you know, somewhat, you know, proverb-like, you know, prose. But I'll read this one here. It's called Detached from the Optics of Failure. There's an anchor quote at the top by Steve Jobs. It says, don't let the noise of others' opinions drown out your own voice. Do not attach yourself to the optics of failure. You are not your circumstances. You are what you decide to do about your circumstances. Jettison any irrational consideration of the opinions of others if they stop at the external and never progress to the heart of who you are and what you're supposed to do. You are not your failures. Actor Dwayne The Rock Johnson knew this in 1995. He chose to see beyond his circumstances and to detach from the optics of his current state of being broke. He recalls, I had $7 in my pocket, knew two things. I'm broke as hell, and one day I won't be. Anyone not living in a complete media star bubble knows that he was right. Through grit, multiple reinventions, and the consistent grind of developing a portfolio of pursuits mindset, The Rock has become the opposite of broke and the antithesis of failure. The Rock's determination and eventual success wasn't just tethered to the discipline of detaching from his current circumstances to see a different future. Along the way, The Rock also maintained an obstinate, healthy adherence to being authentic. In an MTV Awards speech in 2019, he recalled what it was like when he first got to Hollywood. Everyone had an opinion on who he should be, and none of those options were rooted in advising him to be himself. He's half black, half Samoan, built like a biblical giant, and comes from the lowbrow world of professional wrestling. Nobody knew what the hell to do with him. They wanted to shape him, develop him, groom him, change him. The barrage of identity deconstruction advice never stopped. Well, you got to be a certain way. You got to drop some weight. You got to be somebody different. You got to stop working out. You got to stop calling yourself The Rock. But Dwayne Johnson is The Rock. The Rock is built like a brick shit house. And The Rock already has a way of being, and that's a capital B, kind of a nod to Jordan Peterson's thoughts on being. So instead of compromising, he ignored the impressions of others. He wasn't going to allow himself to be a product of the Hollywood environment. Instead, he was going to make it a product of him. I made a choice, he says, and the choice was I wasn't going to conform to Hollywood. Hollywood was going to conform to me. As you see beyond stuck circumstances and bootstrap yourself towards your thing to dream, do not compromise your authenticity. If being your authentic self is a stumbling block, you may have a misaligned North Star dream. Remember the words that Jesus said, for what will profit a man if he gains the whole world and forfeits his soul? I was in existential pain when I decided to shut down my fitness center. It was a euthanized dream, an abandoned pursuit, sacrificed strategically to sustain other dreams and pursuits. It was one tentacle sliced from the octopus of my portfolio of pursuits. I would survive and thrive. I knew this then, but I needed to mourn. I remember at this time I was talking with a friend and was seeking some understanding and support for the emotions I was cycling through in the purging of this pursuit. He was as supportive as he could be, but still only saw the event through the lens of shameful failure. It had to be my fault somehow, not just in terms of having blind spots in the business execution, not just in terms of any failure in performing thorough due diligence, not just in having the audacity to pursue the unknown in a world in which no one ever can predict outcomes. But in his instinctive view, it was a failed idea wholly to begin with. Next time you'll think harder before doing something crazy like that. Next time you won't do something with so much risk. For him, this was all logical and obvious because he would never even think of doing something like that. For him, the meaning of the pursuit was always subordinate to a fidelity to predictable safety and failure avoidance. You cannot listen to those who are stuck in this mindset. For those in your life who detach from the optics of failure, you need to detach from their opinions. It's best to instead follow Leo Tolstoy's advice and be kind and good while ignoring the opinions of others. Find others in your tribe, those who failed and kept going. Watch them, listen to them, and humbly position yourself as their mentee whenever possible. If you unwisely become preoccupied with the opinions and imagined perceptions of others, most notably those of family, you will risk the possibility of your story being written by others at your expense for the benefit of their feelings and satisfaction, all the while neglecting yours. Alt medicine advocate and author Deepak Chopra expresses it this way: what other people think of you is not your business. If you start to make that business, you will be offended for the rest of your life. So heed his advice and mind your business. Allowing other people's thoughts of you to be integrated into the business of your self-worth and decision-making, instead of merely seeing their opinions as ideas to objectively consider, will make you irritable and perennially offended. Why live that way when you can simply be kind while ignoring the misaligned opinions of others? For many of us, it's the voices, real or imagined, of our family that most skews, interrupts, and obfuscates the clarion call of our internal spirit voice. Most people desire favorability, acceptance, approval, and praise from their family for their decisions, and ultimately their way of being. But we are all built like stones, not bricks. We are individual creations with our own special cracks, grooves, nooks, crannies, fault lines, and ornamental beauty and pockmarks. Are we to shoehorn the decisions we make about who we are becoming into a plagiarized brick-shaped mold that duplicates the aggregate mold of our parents? Or one that mirrors the collective opinions and choices of our family? If we do, we muzzle our internal spirit voice and betray the very core of who we are, a mysterious soul formed in a secret place of spiritual essence, knitted together in the depths of our mother's womb. Psychoanalyst and best-selling author Dr. Jordan Peterson talks about how individuality is truly reached when you're respectfully free from fear of judgment by your parents. This doesn't mean that you ought not absorb, internalize, and emulate the beliefs and attributes of your parents that align with your conscience and personality. I certainly hope that my children do. But they and you need to be discerning. Dr. Peterson asserts, one of the times in your life when you actually realize that you're an individual is when you go and ask your parents something and you realize that they don't actually know more about what you should do than you do. And that sucks. Much like the first sting of fresh failure, this does suck. But after this realization sucks, it rules. It rules because as you rise into the comfortable skin of your unique individuality and authenticity, you become strong. That strength will be the foundation that carries you into an adventurous life of seeking alignment with the glorious tumult of your calling journey. Failure throws out the old sheet of paper. It gives you a glorious blank sheet for you to begin sketching the next chapter of your journey with color and enthusiasm. You cannot sketch that next chapter if you're hung up on the optics of your failure. You cannot sketch that next chapter if you're hung up on the opinions, known or anticipated, of others. Your strategy for impression management needs to be completely derelict. Don't manage it at all. Seth Godin, author of Purple Cow, Transform Your Business by Being Remarkable, explains his observation of this hang-up this way. We don't choose to be remarkable because we're worried about criticism. We hesitate to create innovative movies, launch new human resources initiatives, design a menu that makes diners take notice or give an audacious sermon because we're worried deep down that someone will hate it and call us on it. Learn to accept that people may not like what you do, create, or choose. Learn to be okay with the idea that people may hate you. We're all very different. If you're doing anything bold or interesting, someone somewhere is bound to hate you. Smile. It's okay. Sometimes it's even fun. Detach from the optics of your failures. Outline the next chapter of your life with audacity, and then be kind and ignore the opinions of others. Don't try to manage the impressions you might make. You are not your failures. Little long-winded. Sorry about that.
Oh, man, it's beautiful.
Long to read, but that's one chapter in the new book.
I'm sold. I like it. I mean, one thing that really rung so true to me while you were reading this is I think in sort of the beginning there, it was talking about being comfortable with who you are and really not letting people talk down to you. It's like, oh, well, you're no good at this. You can't do that. So you should just quit. But I think the problem is a lot of people don't know who the heck they are. And they get told who they are by everybody else instead of just going like, oh, you know what? I'm cool with this. I'm all right if I can't land this trick. I'm all right if I'm not the best drawer in the world. I'm all right. You know, whatever. That doesn't mean I'm a failure. It doesn't mean I'm going to quit and just never do it again.
Yeah. I mean, it kind of goes along with, I mean, one of the themes in the book is the notion, like I explained, of your internal spirit voice. And if you let that be muzzled by listening to others, you're not going to hear it and you're not going to be following through with what you ought, you know. It's, I mean, it's like that, you know, that the movie with Will Smith, Pursuit of Happiness, you know. There's that one scene where he's got his son, and it's depicting Chris Gardner, you know, who the movie's about, where, you know, Chris Gardner had just gone through, you know, this failure of poverty, he was homeless, you know, and he's bootstrapping his way back up. He's dealing with what Chris Gardner would call placism, which is, you know, being judged for your place in life. And that's how he described his circumstances at the time. And he's playing basketball with his son, and his son's getting really into it. He's getting animated. And I'm just kind of paraphrasing here. And you know, at one point, he kind of just moderates his son's ambition. And he's like, you know, you're probably just going to end up being mediocre at this, and you're probably just going to be okay. So I don't want you out here all night, day and night, shooting these hoops. And again, I'm just paraphrasing. But
sure.
And, you know, and then there's this moment you see his son just kind of shrinking and just being, having his ambition squashed, and his head kind of goes down. He's walking away. And then Will Smith playing Chris Gardner catches what he did and then says to him, look, when you want to do something, go after it. No matter what anybody tells you, even if I tell you that, go after it. If you want something, chase it. You know, and again, I'm paraphrasing.
Oh yeah.
But that's the idea, you know, like he fell into himself, you know, speaking to his son the same way he had heard his ex-wife earlier in the movie speak to him that he ignored. And the key is to know when to ignore it, you know? And that doesn't mean we press forward with pursuits where we're failing so bad that it's you know, it's destroying our lives or we're completely delusional. I mean, of course, there's got to be reason applied to everything. But generally, I think it's a good principle to be aware of what you want versus what the rest of the world tells you you ought to want.
Yeah, I mean, I think it goes back to that discernment angle. I was reading that with my daughter weeks ago now in Proverbs, and it was this topic of discernment came up. You know, it's kind of hard to really explain and measure. But sadly, I think it's because so much of society doesn't have that anymore. They don't have that drive or that voice that says, hey, you know, this is probably a bad idea. Don't do that. Or, you need to pursue this angle because X, Y, and Z, it might lead you to a much better position or success or, you know, whatever.
Yeah. And to me, I mean, discernment really is like, it goes back to like the difference between a compass and a map, right? You know?
Yeah.
I mean, the reality is there's really no map for what anybody ought to do. You know, there's guideposts, you know, there might be a general compass, and the difference between which micro steps you take is based on your own discernment, you know? And we live in a world that tells us we should constantly be paying more attention to consensus building and paying more attention to the supposed experts in our lives. And I think sometimes we're blinded to that kind of, you know, ethereal spirit voice inside that really helps us discern regardless of what certain experts might say, regardless of what the consensus around us might tell us, you know? And, you know, so I agree. I think, you know, discernment and following our own conscience and hearing that voice is hyper important.
I mean, this could be an obvious question, but all the stuff you've had irons in the fire with, from the record label to the banking to the books and so much more. I mean, what was leading you? What was that discernment, I guess, looking like for you? Was it, hey, you don't need to do this. You should go back to the record label? Or was it, hey, you should go back to the steel factory?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's part of the tough thing to figure out too, you know, in writing this book. I mean, one of the themes was, what is a calling? You know, is a calling some destination? Is a calling that 1950s version of, I'm going to be X and I'm going to go to college to study X, and damn it, after I graduate, I'm going to be X the rest of my life because it's my calling? Or is a calling more of kind of your way of being in life, and whatever you're pursuing, they all kind of stack up to cumulatively make you the you that you ought to be. And I think it's the latter, you know, and I think that's kind of how my life's been. So it's, you know, regardless of what pursuit I'm involved in, or usually it's a handful of pursuits, it's what are those core principles? What are those core things I'm passionate about that I think have over time become indicative of who I am and have given me the most meaning and could somehow be called my calling, you know? So, you know, I've always felt like I've heard that inner voice. I don't often make a lot of big decisions with a lot of input from a lot of people. And when I do, it's often virtual mentors of just accumulated wisdom from reading and from praying and from, you know, whether it be faith principles or philosophical principles that inform my decisions. You know, and I think that gives me a little bit more purity and clarity as I go to make these decisions. Even if when I decide something, it doesn't work out, sometimes it still works out anyway, you know, and that's part of not being afraid of failure, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one thing I see all over in society now is that people just can't make just baseline decisions. It doesn't matter if it's like, what we're eating for dinner tonight, or if it's this car or moving to Omaha, whatever, like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like people have to like, let's consult the council. And I'm like, screw the council. Let's hammer this out and we'll figure out what the heck we're doing. If it fails, you know, Chinese food sucks tonight. Tomorrow we'll have Mexican or whatever, you know.
That's one of the hardest things for me, because I've always been, you know, not isolated, but I've always been an individual thinker, and I make decisions, even if not quickly, usually with a good deal of clarity of at least knowing what the risks are going to be and being willing to face them, you know. And when I started kind of, you know, corporate life, after being either a solopreneur or an entrepreneur with partners in various businesses most of my life, and having that be the majority of my income, and shifting to a corporate environment, it was very difficult to understand the slow labyrinth of the bureaucracy and the consensus building and the committees and all that. I've come to see the value in it. I understand why it's valuable, but it's still very difficult and goes against my nature when I'm usually a little more punk rock and bootstrap about it. And I usually, you know, I still adhere to, you know, a little bit of, you know, ready, fire, aim, you know, maybe not exactly ready, fire, aim, but, you know, ready, you know, approximate your aim, fire, and then refine your aim in flight. I mean, that's really kind of the way I go. I think that too many people are sitting around waiting for perfect aim, and then they never fire, and they miss out on really the excitement of doing the things they ought to do in life.
Oh yeah. I mean, it's ever present out there in the corporate world and in the academia world. It's like, let's get a committee together and we'll all get groupthink consensus on it, and then we'll make the call. And I'm good. You guys just do your thing. I'll hang out, make this.
It's, you know, again, it's one of those things where like it's a necessity of functioning in the world, of having relationships and being a part of things larger than yourself. But the more you can minimize that, in the same way that I believe the more we can minimize government, I think the better we're off we are, you know.
So many folks just do whatever they do just because they think that's what they have to do. I mean, it's been several years since I've really taught in person, but I'd say like the last 5 years when I was teaching, I would sort of make the classes say, why are you here? You know, like, why are you at university? As one of their little like five icebreaker questions, along with like, hey, I'm Scott, I'm from whatever, you know.
Yeah.
I would just make them say, like, why are you here? You know, like, this is a pretty steep investment, so why are you doing it? And I swear to you, man, at least 95% of the answers were just because that's what you do. That's what you do. We got it. Yeah. We got to have this 4-year degree. This is what you do. And I mean, I wasn't going to call everybody out and be like, you're idiots. What the hell's wrong with you? But at the same time, I was going, man, you could have opened your own business. You could have become an apprentice as a welder. You could be an electrician. You could be a plumber. I mean, open a paint business. I mean, come on.
Yeah. I mean, when it comes to college, I mean, we've just bought into this kind of this societal lie and this automaticism attached to college that it's always good, it's always necessary, and oh my God in heaven, if you don't go, your life is going to be ruined and you're going to be flipping burgers, you're going to be doing something hard, you're going to be miserable in life. And it's just not true. I mean, of course, college can be an important differentiator. Of course, college can be good for many people. But when you look at the cost benefit, what does good mean? And how much good are you getting for that cost and that risk? And what other good might you be able to get for that cost? I mean, might you be able to buy an established business? Might you have been able to stay at home and work for free in a field you love as in an apprenticeship and climb up in a more, you know, surgical way into something you know you want to do? I mean, you know, there's a lot of different ways to go about it. And I think with technology and, you know, especially now, if you look at COVID and, you know, the decentralizing of everything, you know, I can't imagine it's going to be long before higher education really gets disrupted. I mean, it's underwritten by the federal government, which inflates and, you know, allows for fraudulent tuition. And the ROI on it is just highly suspect for many people. You know, yeah, there's some intangibles, but I don't know how much you really want to pay for a 4-year summer camp. I mean, it's just, and I went to college, but you know, there's many times where I feel like if I hadn't gone to college, I would have probably had the same path in life and I might have, failed quicker, learned things quicker. And, you know, I'm not sure that necessarily was a real benefit other than, you know, being that kind of, you know, you know, mark just to get into certain jobs. But once you're in, I don't know how much difference it really makes if you're a self-directed person.
I mean, that entrepreneurial spirit thing is so important. For you, did that come from just kind of like that DIY ethos of, you know, we can make our own zines, our own stickers and promo everything, or was it something else?
No, that's where it came from. I mean, when I was like, you know, whatever, sixth, seventh grade, I was making my own zines for like, you know, freestyle BMX and skateboarding and punk rock and distributing them, you know. And then it's just like, I always just want to do it myself. I just didn't, I never liked the idea that I had to go be chosen by somebody. It's like that book by James Altucher, Choose Yourself. You know, it's just, I always kind of had to choose myself mentality. And that's from when I was very, very young. You know, I just did not understand why I had to wait for gatekeepers if I could find a way to scrap together the tools myself to make a go for it, whatever that it was. You know, so it's definitely a punk rock thing, man. I mean, I for me, entrepreneurialism, punk rock, you know, individuality, libertarianism, all those things are all highly synonymous for me.
What you mentioned earlier, I so much identify with that whole just I've chosen to self-isolate thing. Like, I was joking with people when this COVID hoax first started. I was like, dude, I've been doing this for 20 years. This isn't too much of a change for me. Like, I don't want to interact with humans. So,
right.
Yeah. But I mean, I think Henry Rollins and a few others touched on this where they started working out because it's something they could just do by themselves. They didn't have to have a team. Like, same with me. I started working out because, like, I just need some weights and I don't even need weights. You can do a push ups on the floor and pull ups in the park or whatever. And same with skating, man. I don't really like these clowns that want to skate, so I can just go skate in this parking lot by myself. It's a win-win.
Well, and usually you think about it too, like the things that are detached from teams have much more creative possibilities. I mean, I just never understood when I was younger. Like, I played sports a little bit when I was really younger, and then I just stopped. I was like, wait, so you're telling me I have to go to school because I have to, and I have to listen to people tell me what to do all day. And then you want me to volunteer to have more people tell me what to do after school? Get the hell out of here. I ain't doing any of that. So, you know, I was into like skateboarding and, you know, bodybuilding, rock climbing and, you know, most BMX freestyle, you know, stuff like that. And, you know, I just didn't understand any of that. But, you know, I was physically active always. And there were things that were creative, you know, and there was still camaraderie with my friends, not a team. But camaraderie and, you know, building those kind of like relationships that matter through those type of experiences, you know? So yeah, I was just like that. And I'm not knocking sports. I think obviously there's some virtue to sports and teamwork does have applicability in the world. And I understand all that. And there's still discipline there, which is important, but just for me, man, I had to go off road.
Yeah.
So I couldn't stand those tracks, you know?
I'm right there with you. I mean, later in life, I really liked just shooting basketball. And I came to the realization I didn't really like playing. I just like being out there by myself, just shooting. You know, it's dark. Nobody's out there. It's fine.
Yeah. Sounds like me and fishing. I just like being on the boat and having a cigar and a drink. I really don't care about the fish. That's just answering.
Yeah, I mean, it's weird. So much of that stuff is the little bit of interaction is just kind of that camaraderie, like the punk and hardcore scene. Yeah. It's like, oh yeah, we're brothers because we're out here enjoying this band and helping somebody up when they get knocked down or whatever. But
yeah, sharing in electric moments, man, you know, and just, you know, just the zeitgeist of the scene, you know, the zeitgeist of the times, you know, just having someone who gets it the same way you do, whatever the scene is, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I think entrepreneurs have that today too, you know, and you have people who are into a tech who are that way, or you have writers are that way, you know, or whatever the scene is, you know, and I think that's a special thing when you find that, you know, and usually it creates something, you know. I mean, you think of even like some of the comedians today who are somewhat, you know, aligned in a bit of a scene, even though they're all individual and unique and, you know, it creates kind of an era to look back on, and at the end, it becomes kind of carved out and noteworthy.
Yeah, I loved your video that you sent me as well. The top 10 most punk rock
heroes of the new right.
Yeah, heroes of the new right. Thank you. That was fabulous, and I couldn't agree more. It was for me like I was watching it and thinking back, you know, when I sort of like figured out all the politics mess, because for years I must have been the most naive punk kid in the world, because I was just like, whatever, I don't really have like an identity of right or left. And then later on, you know, as I got older, got the house and the family and all that, I was like, man, you know, I believe in X, Y, and Z. Huh. I guess that means I'm a conservative kind of guy. Huh? All right, cool. You know, like it wasn't like this huge line moment where I'm putting a big R on my chest and all that stuff. It was kind of like, okay, well, that's what I've always been. So that works, you know?
Yeah. 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 I mean, I made that video really because I just found that it's been really like refreshing to see in recent years. Mm-hmm. And regardless of how you feel about Trump or whether you vote of him or like him or what have you, this really has nothing to do with that. Although I think the fact that he kind of came in like Rodney Dangerfield and Caddyshack and just blew things up, you know, and just, you know, offended people by his mere being, created the opportunity for others to be themselves and not worry about offending others as well. And to kind of not have to fit into either party or either ideology in some sort of rigid way. I mean, there wouldn't have been, you know, a Milo, there wouldn't have been a Gavin McGinnis, there wouldn't have been Peter Thiel speaking at the Republican convention, there wouldn't have been some of these personalities that historically would have been rejected by the stuffy, you know, country club rigid right that have now come in and say, you know, I don't agree with everything on this side of the aisle, but these certain things absolutely do agree with. And I find myself drifting more on this side than the other side. And it kind of gave that ability for nuance to find its voice and for individuality. And, you know, I love that. I just love that when people are able to really speak their minds and be their authentic selves, even when I absolutely don't agree with them, I applaud it. And I think that we need more of that. We need more speech, not less. We need to learn how to not be offended. And I think another thing too is you always hear about the word divisiveness. This is divisive, that's divisive, this person's divisive. Mm-hmm. Since when is divisiveness always bad? I mean,
that just means he's followed his own path. That's great.
Yeah, I mean, like in my personal life, do I want to be divisive with my friends and my family? No. You know, you accept the difference of opinion and personality and all that stuff, and that's a beautiful tapestry, right? When it comes to like the corridors of struggling for influence and input in the, you know, in public policy or, you know, things of that nature, I mean, divisiveness is normal. It's expected. It means that there's a healthy disparate, you know, set of opinions that people are passionate about. I mean, even think of like Jesus, you know, he's made it very clear, like, oh, you thought I came to bring peace? No, I came to bring a sword. It's divisiveness. You know, this assumption that unity at all was the norm in the human condition throughout the history of the world is a joke. I mean, divisiveness really is the norm. And, you know, I think there's destructive divisiveness and there's healthy divisiveness, of course, but this idea that the word divisiveness itself or the presence of divisiveness is always bad, I think is not true.
I mean, I completely agree. What you're supposed to do, taking the easy path, probably not the best road. If you look at all those choices, like we were talking about earlier, just making those easy life choices. If you go with the easy path every time, you're going to end up working at Hardee's for 20 years and that's going to be it. No problem.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's also the idea of, you know, be hot or be cold, lukewarm or spit you out, you know? I have a quote in my book from the author Roald Dahl about, you know, live your life hot, man. Live your life hot. That's the way to do it. You know, and, you know, I think when you live your life hot, there's a chance you can divide people. I mean, Rick Rubin, the great producer, you know, produced everything from Slayer to Johnny Cash, right? Mm-hmm. Think of the two religious ideologies and the differences there. Produce everybody from Eminem to Kanye West. Think of the difference in political ideologies right there, yeah. You know, produced whatever, Danzig, Kid Rock, Beastie Boys. He's quoted as saying, you know, great art divides the audience. And I think just in general, regardless of the arena, greatness often divides. If you're not dividing somebody, you're probably really not doing anything really noteworthy or great.
Yeah, I mean, that's such a good point. When you were talking about Gavin, I was trying to look up this because I recall like the first time I heard him speaking, and it was kind of like one of those first times I heard punk or hardcore. I was like, holy cow, man, I'm not alone. Right. There's another kid out there that thinks the same way.
Yeah.
But one of the first things I heard, he was, oh man, I cannot think of the band. It was on that Sunday matinee, New York City comp, but it was the song, We're the Working Class of the USA, and it's about time.
YDL.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, Youth Defense League. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yes, that was Youth Defense League. Thank you, man. Thank you. But he
I remember hearing that song in ninth grade on that. Yeah.
He was doing like an interview because I guess the singer had come out, you know, this was like 6 years ago or something, but the singer had come out and like kind of denounced his old band and like, oh, I shouldn't have made that song because it was divisive. And, right. and Gavin was just like, what a bunch of hogwash, man. Like, it's a song. What are you talking about?
I know. Yeah. I mean, it's like a certain point in life, if you're comfortable with who you are, you need to be comfortable with being hated sometimes.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of like those tattoos and scars thing. Like, I did a lot of dumb stuff back in the day, but, you know, sorry, it sucked at the time, I guess.
Yeah. 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 No, he's definitely a voice that needs to be, continue to be heard, even as those push to ostracize and demonetize him, which he just takes glee in anyway. So he's just. It's, you know, it's like the Jack in the Box, you know, you punch a Jack in the Box, pops back up with a smiley face anyway, always finds a way, you know, and, you know, being pushed out or hated or failing doesn't deter, you know, you just keep going, you know.
Because sadly, it's usually the time, like when people first get any kind of pushback or resistance, 90% of the population is like, okay, all right, maybe I should just keep doing, maybe I should do the go along to get along thing.
Mm-hmm.
Where guys like us were like, ah, screw you. We're just going to keep going. Yeah. Bugger off, right. for lack of a more harsh term.
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah.
And because it's usually when you're getting that little bit of resistance that you're making that traction and you're about to, you know, hit the apex and go down the slide. You're not going to get anywhere if everybody's like, hey, man, I love your work, Andrew. It's the best. It's just wonderful. It's great.
Yeah,
it's those detractors that feed you.
Yeah, people don't push back on anybody or any idea that isn't starting to get resonance, you know? They only push back when it's starting to encroach. So you just got to keep encroaching. Keep stiff upper lip. Keep going, you know?
Well, I know you touched on it a little bit, but I wanted to talk about it before we close things up. Is the role of God in this whole thing? Because that's something you don't hear a lot of in the punk and hardcore scene, or at least not enough.
Yeah. For me, I mean, I remember being 16 years old and reading Pissing in the Gene Pool by Henry Rollins, his book, and you know, reading it and going, wow, you know, there's a whole lot of nihilism here. Probably didn't know what that word meant then, but you know, looking back, that's what that was. And I felt this emptiness pit in my stomach, like, is this the world? You know, and it was a well-written book and a lot of insights, and I have a lot of respect for him. But, you know, I felt like there was something more, that there had to be kind of a cure to this diagnosis of dysfunction in the world, this diagnosis of a, you know, sullen human condition. And it was that time where I really kind of just doubted my doubts and ended up embracing, you know, relationship with God. And, you know, and then my life changed from there. But obviously still am who I am, still a punk rocker, still a free thinker, an individual, and all of that. But, you know, for certain, for me, when I talk about this internal spirit voice in the book Failure Rules, I mean, for me, I recognize it as God, sure.
Yeah.
So, yeah. You know, and I think back to even like, you know, when I was writing for Chord Magazine, I did an interview with John Joseph of the Cro-Mags, who I love. Cro-Mags, one of my favorite bands. Oh, man, bands.
Love Cro-Mags.
I have a Cro-Mags tattoo, you know, one of my favorite humans. He's got some great books out, too. And obviously, we don't agree on the same things, but I just love the way he operates in the world. And I remember he was just talking about, you know, his notion of detachment from the material world and from his Hare Krishna philosophy. And, you know, and I remember listening to him and, you know, listening to how he became a Hare Krishna from HR from Bad Brains, talking about Rastafarianism. Mm-hmm. You know, and so I think back, and in some ways, I mean, watching the boldness of, you know, Bad Brains or Cro-Mags introducing spirituality to the hardcore punk scene allowed me to embrace Christianity and still retain my, you know, my love and embracing of hardcore punk. You know, there's room there. There should be room, because to me, hardcore and punk is a spirit. It's an approach of life. It's not an ideology. It's not a religion, and it should allow for the freedom of any of that.
Resonated with me. It just, your beginning of your work and looking at that stuff, I was like, yeah, I mean, that's what it's all about. It's not about the spiked hair or the docs, mm-hmm. or X, Y, or Z. It's really that internal drive, you know, that kind of got me there in the first place. It was like, well, I don't fit in here. I don't fit in there. These guys look pretty angry and they're singing about the way I feel.
Yeah.
Okay. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, exactly right. I mean, the fashion is secondary, you know? Not that, I mean, the fashion certainly has some sort of external representation of the internal as well, right? I mean, I think that, you know, we all look to have some sort of congruence between the way we represent ourselves in the world, you know, visually and what's going on inside of us, you know, for sure. But it's what's going on inside of us that matters the most. You know, that should be the driver of everything else, you know?
Absolutely right. That is the key right there. Well, aside from getting your book, which is the obvious, any great words of wisdom for those folks out there just probably listening to this going like, well, I don't know what I'm doing. I don't know where I'm going. And I'm graduating high school. I'm about to graduate college or whatever, you know?
Yeah.
Kind of think I know what it might be, but go for it.
Yeah. So that book's not out yet. I can't wait till it is. But I would say, again, just block everything out. Listen to your own spirit voice first. Think of those things that you've always loved to do. You've always been attracted to do. If it's not clear how you might monetize being involved in whatever that is, think differently about it. Think about kind of the adjacent pieces of that hobby or passion or, you know, career path that might actually work to monetize first and get in that way. You know, for me, I wanted to get involved in the music industry. So I started writing for music magazines. Well, that didn't work. Still wanted to be involved. So I ended up working for other record labels and getting a paid education to go start my own record labels. And then that, you know, kind of snowballed from there. So find a nook, find a cranny that can sustain you while you're learning to find the next nook and find the next cranny. And, you know, if college is a piece of that journey, fine. But don't just accept that it has to be, particularly at a price, you know, both financially and in terms of wasting the years in your life, if that's what it ends up being for you. And just, you know, know that really it's, you know, your entire quote unquote calling or career journey will likely be, for most people these days, is mostly a zigzag. And if you have multiple careers or multiple jobs within a career, that's not only normal, that's healthy, that'll make you stronger and more well-rounded as you continue to go. And the other idea I would impress upon people that, you know, I try to retain with varying degrees of success over my life is build a portfolio of pursuits. Try to find a way to have interest and income redundancy through a variety of things at once. Always have some sort of side hustle and try to find things where they serve you instead of you serving it, where your hustle allows you to have leverage as opposed to you being leveraged to somebody else's idea or hustle, you know?
Yeah, that's such a good point, man. I love what you were bringing up with the apprenticeship angle as well, because so many people just are lost to that today. You know, like if you can find somebody doing what you're doing or what you want to do, rather, hang out with them. Do that mentorship thing. Do that apprenticeship thing, man.
I mean, that's what I did when I wanted to learn how to be in the music industry. I found a guy who ran a record label. I shadowed him. I learned the contracts, learned what he did. Most of it was from bad advice from a guy who ultimately failed and had a cocaine problem. But, you know, then that still taught me a lot of things. And then I moved on. And then I had a larger – then I started working for record labels and distributors and learning more. But, like – and getting paid nothing. Like, nothing. I ended up, you know, at one point making more money off my record label that I built from that knowledge, staying up till 2 a.m. doing it than the day job. But, you know, that's how you do it, man. It's got to be grit. And you got to kind of look for those – circumventing paths, you know. Nobody's gonna lay it out for you. Nobody's gonna lay it out for you. And even what I say, you know, it's not like something that's it's how you apply it. It's not guaranteed, you know. But you have to have that mentality that you're gonna seek it out, and you're gonna seek it out even in strange ways with strange approaches.
I remember I was listening to somebody one time because I had my certification. I was going to do the personal trainer thing. And I was listening to another trainer talk about this. And he said, you know, at the end of the day, you got to have your side hustle. You got to be doing more than one thing at once, because at the end of the day, you're just one guy. So you can only train X amount of people a day. Even if you get up at 3 a.m, you know, at some point you got to sleep, eat, and yeah. So, you know, you got to have some other income coming in and stuff like that.
Yeah. And it's like, it goes to concentration risk. I mean, any good business has multiple revenue sources to feed into that business. Well, in the business of you, what are the multiple revenue sources? What's your concentration risk and your main source of income or revenue? If that's too high a percentage of the overall portfolio of your personal revenue in the business of you, that's a problem. You got to look to diversify that, reduce your concentration risk. It's just applying a basic business principle to your own personal economic life, you know? And but people don't think that way. They buy into the kind of the safety mentality, or they become safety files, as I would put them. And they just think, well, I got a company's taking care of me for now. And they're just, you know, put my money in my 401k, which is great. But it doesn't take much for a company who, views you as leverage to just let you go. And what do you have from there? What did you build for yourself on the side to help kind of buffer against that eventuality, you know? And, you know, it's tough to think that way, and it's even tougher to implement it, but that's the challenge. And I think that's, if you're able to do it, you're going to be in a better position.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that worked so well for our parents' generation, perhaps, but so many folks, you know, in between our generation and theirs got laid off and got furloughed and everything else, that it kind of, I feel for me anyway, I was kind of like very reticent to say, yeah, I'm going to go get a job at GE or Corning for the next 30 years or whatever.
Yeah. I mean, the job for life dream is by and large been smashed. There's some that still are able to have that. But I mean, a stretch at a company for 5+ years is a big deal these days, you know, 10+ years is a bigger deal. It's rare.
Yeah.
To be there, you know, longer than that is really, really rare. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's great. But even in that, even if you love your job, you love what you do, which right now I do, it still behooves one to still do other things on the side for, you know, diversity of creative fulfillment, diversity of income, and just being a well-rounded person.
Absolutely. Well, how can everyone support you and find everything as far as your work, your books and record label, Hold On Yards? How can they help?
Yeah. So, right now, the only book that's out is Blaze Operation Persian Trinity. You can find that on Amazon. The other two books will be coming out next year. That's Caliph, Ottoman Rising, which is a spy novel I'm working with Joel Richardson on. And then Failure Rules, the 8 Rules of Failure for Entrepreneurs, Creatives, and Authentics. That'll be out next year. AndrewThorpeKing.com is my website. You can find me on, you know, on Facebook and Twitter and all that. And yeah. That's where you can go support it.
Well, that sounds amazing, man. And if anyone missed that, if you're driving around at the gym or somewhere, Don't worry, you can look at anomicage.com and you can find all of Andrew's work. All the links are going to be available in the guest media section. So his websites, all the book links, all that jazz will be there too, as well as today's show with the video and the audio. So as I always say, you can't do everything, but you can do something. So please try to get out there and make that difference. And until next time, I'll be seeing you sooner than later in the Anomic Age.
Thank you for listening to The Anomic Age, a John Age project. For past shows, further info, and to comment, go to anomicage.com. That's A-N-O-M-I-C-A-G-E.com. Till next time, thank you for listening to The Anomic Age. I'm gonna go to bed.